the Neil Haley Show. And I tell you, my days are getting busier and busier. And always enjoy Thursday nights to record because they're such amazing guests that maybe I wouldn't have the time to interview, but I wish I could interview 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, because it's just so much fun what I get to learn. So I'm excited to welcome to first my co-host, Sarah Bella. Again, the Surreal segment. Sarah, how are you? I got a millennial on the line. I don't know if you're going to agree with her the entire time, but Sarah, we have a really interesting guest that's written for a bunch of different places, and her expertise is, again, talking to millennials. So go ahead and tell who our guest is.
Oh, excellent. Yes, as a millennial, I'll try not to be biased, no. But I'm really excited to introduce Gabrielle Boucher. She's president and founder of The Millennial Solution, is a TEDx speaker, which I love TEDx, and is a contributor to HuffPost and Washington Times. How are you, Gabrielle?
I'm doing so well. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Absolutely. Great. Let's get going. I want to see two millennials and see their differences. That's going to be a lot of fun as I'm 45 watching this, listening to this, so it'll be fun. Okay, go ahead, Sarah.
I think it's super important to first define what is a millennial? Like, where is the start and stop, if there is a start and stop of who is a millennial?
Yep, it's one of the biggest questions I get asked whenever I'm speaking or working with clients is who are millennials, and a close second is what's wrong with them. So the first question is, really, millennials are born between 1982 and 2000. So we're talking about 18 to 37-year-olds. So this isn't a generation of college students. I mean, they're starting businesses, getting married, having kids, buying their first home. It's really a massive generation, frankly, the largest generation in American history.
Okay, so my generation, again, I'm Gen Xer. I'm 45, Gabrielle. So I know you study all these things. What age groups are for the Gen X? What years after you talk about 37 on? Just for so I can kind of compare myself, because you're not at least having a 60-year-old interviewing you, Gabrielle. At least I'm close to that millennial age. I never knew that I was cut off by 8 years. That's not that bad.
I know, you're so close. You're so close, Neil. No, Gen X is born between 1965 and 1981. So although one-third the size of the millennial generation, definitely a generation that's extremely independent, extremely entrepreneurial, and as I'm sure your listeners have learned, very independent-minded. Certainly a very different generation than the millennial generation, but I like to call you guys the bridger generation between baby boomers and our generation.
Mm-hmm. All right. Interesting so far.
I think that describes
educating
you.
Us. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Oh, me? Oh, thank you. So Sarah says that describes me. Okay, thank you. I'm carrying the Gen X. Yeah, absolutely. All right, Sarah. Well, now I know you have you're waiting to ask those questions about, especially Democrats, which the topic tonight again is how Democrats are getting fed up with. I mean, millennials getting fed up with Democratic candidates. So go ahead, Sarah.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, why do you think, I mean, I don't know if I 100% understand, but why do people think millennials are fed up with different parties, you know, at least even internally part of the Democratic Party, or potentially not fond of Trump?
So what's interesting, there's actually a recent Reuters poll that just came out where it showed that about 2 out of 3 millennial voters do not like, in their terms of like, Donald Trump. But interestingly enough, they're not necessarily translating their like or dislike of the president into whether or not they're going to be supporting Republicans or Democrats come the 2018 midterms. So this is a generation where I'm sure both of you have noticed that millennials are not prone to prefer one party over the other. So they're not necessarily going to be considered Democrats or Republicans. Millennials are really one of the first generations in American history that really consider themselves political independents, where in fact a majority of them actually say they're neither Democrat nor Republican. So when it comes to individuals looking to capture the millennial market, when it comes to to running for office, they've really got to capture the millennial imagination. You have to connect to some of the issues that millennials are most excited about and not worry as much about politics and worry more about personalities and how you're able to relate to this next generation.
Wow, and that's so interesting, Gabrielle, when you talk about that. And I think that the simple fact is I'm going to define millennials, both of you guys, is that you really don't have it depends on each millennial. They're different in so many ways in how they're going to define things, especially that we're used to generations defining based on the traditional media. The traditional media of the three channels and what you're going to watch on television and some cable, but now with all these streaming things and stuff, some don't even watch the news anymore. They get their news from Facebook. I sometimes do as well. I can or other places or get it from a specific area. So, Gabrielle, they are not really, you know, what traditionally happened to kind of drum up support for the Democratic Party or vice versa, the Republican Party, because Democrats and Republicans, have still not figured out how to grab this group. I think that's the big thing.
Well, sir, I think that you made an incredible point there, because not only has neither party done a great job in capturing millennials, both parties have really underestimated millennials. So keep in mind, millennials are the largest generation that's ever existed, largest part of the workforce, largest part of the consumer market, on par when it comes to voting with baby boomers. But here's the thing. Come 2020, millennials are going to be the majority of the electorate. So that means that if you don't appeal to this next generation, if you don't craft a strategy that resonates with anyone between ages 18 to 37, the massive age group there, 18 to 37-year-olds, you're not going to win. And that's, I think, the big message that both parties need to really take home and understand, that this generation is a generation that can't be ignored, should not be ignored, and a generation that, frankly, is just ready to be engaged with.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Exactly.
For sure.
Interesting. And, you know, why are many millennials not loyal to the Democratic candidate, per, you know, just having a title as Democratic candidate? What are millennials looking for beyond just a label?
Really interesting question, because I've studied millennials for over 11 years and really focused on millennial motivation. So what motivates millennials to buy, what motivates millennials to work for certain companies. And during the last election, we were brought on by a number of candidates to discover what millennials wanted when it came to a political candidate. And it really came down to two phrases: authenticity and accountability. Millennials really wanted a candidate who wasn't afraid to admit that they were wrong, but a candidate who was just openly authentic with who they were, not a candidate who was going to kind of hide the ball, so to speak. And so that's why you saw many millennials flocking towards a Bernie Sanders-like candidate who was significantly older, but who represented many of the ideals, talked about repaying college loans, talked about now he's back in the news talking about free jobs. So he's talking about some of the issues that this generation is concerned about, but that doesn't necessarily mean that those individuals, that part of my generation who was excited about Bernie Sanders as a candidate, can't be captured by Republicans. It has everything to do with how you phrase the conversation, and has a lot less to do with kind of the ideology, which so many Republicans and conservatives in particular are really held up on when they're trying to reach people who are under the age of 35.
See, that's very interesting, and I think that's the thing. The Bernie Sanders candidate really is thrown the mix of what truly a Democrat is, Gabrielle. And what millennials want is something like Bernie Sanders that's really a new free thinker, somebody that has, I believe, and this is kind of a shocking thing, as I guess I call myself a semi-conservative in this process of my kind of formation from the days of Trump, but before looking at things, is that Bernie really is thinking of the people and less about the system. And that's what really made people really interested in Bernie Sanders, which now confuses Democrats. Where do we go in our direction? Bernie's looking at, he had ideals of the Democrats, but also he had ideals that was even further that's not been a norm in either party, right?
Yeah, it certainly has. And again, I mean, he's made news recently saying, you know, no one in America should live without a job. And, you know, we should be providing jobs for everyone, which, you know, certainly isn't the solution for everything. And certainly isn't the main issue, particularly now that we have unemployment under 4%. And particularly for a generation, millennials, who for many of us, keep in mind, we graduated college into an economic recession. So many of us went to college, did the 4 years, sometimes 5 or 6 years, to graduate college. And because we thought we were going to be promised a good job. And those good jobs either weren't hiring or weren't paying enough or maybe weren't the jobs that they thought that they were going to be. So it certainly is important for either party to understand, you know, how do we communicate to a generation that's experiencing economic growth for the first time in, frankly, their entire lives, you know, what our party is going to do to make sure that this not only lasts, but it actually has a real effect on their bank accounts, on their savings, and on their future.
Wow. That's very, very interesting. Sarah, kind of what is your thought when she's saying this? It's surprising for sure.
I mean, to me, it doesn't feel that surprising. I can resonate with that, and, you know, a generation of, you know, an emphasis for education, but, you know, the number of jobs, the types of jobs are declining, especially due to automaticity. There's a need for a lot of experience in entry-level jobs nowadays. So people are more pushed towards those internships in the beginning. And it's just kind of, you know, that system of overeducated, underemployed. And I've seen that. And I've seen that happen where it's kind of more of a norm to just get those low-paying internships to build that necessary experience. But, you know, in the next, you know, political race, what, you know, who do the Democrats need to run to help the Democrats win the next presidential election? And what kind of figure would resonate with the people? And you've kind of, you know, touched on this, but who do the Democrats need to run to help the Democrats win the next presidential election?
Well, not only the presidential, but also to when it comes to the next midterm. So the Democratic Party, the DNC just launched the hashtag I Will Vote campaign earlier this year, really in hopes of helping millennials turn out to vote. Now, as I mentioned at the top of our discussion, that a recent Reuters poll actually showed that millennials are not as interested in voting for Democrats as they are Republicans, particularly going into the midterm election, which is certainly interesting, you know, any candidate, Democrat or Republican, is really going to have to appease a generation who is looking for that authenticity factor. And that's what's fascinating about either candidate, is if it's a Democrat or a Republican, millennials don't care as much whether they're running under the banner of a Democrat or a Republican. They're looking for whether or not this candidate actually reflects the priorities and concerns of this generation. So primarily there are three things that millennials are concerned about. The first is they're looking for jobs in the economy, and that's really across the board when it comes to looking at generations. Is, you know, every generation wants to know, do I have a job? Is there a future? Am I going to be secure in myself and my family? But number two, millennials are looking at student loan debt. The average millennial has about $38,000 in student loan debt. So they're looking at, you know, is there an option to have it either repaid? Is there a private sector solution, which is something that myself and my firm, the Millennial Solution, is working on actively with members of Congress. And the third issue really has to do with personal freedom, security, and opportunity. 67% of millennials say that they want to start their own business one day. So this is a generation that's incredibly entrepreneurial, incredibly excited about the opportunity to be their own boss one day. And so they're looking at electing a candidate who they feel is going to secure that opportunity for them to be able to make their own money, keep their own money, and frankly have a more secure future than they have experienced in the past. So candidates on both sides of the aisle are really going to have to hit those three pain points if they're going to win millennial voters come the fall.
That's very true. So best thing we can do to find information on you so you can tell us what's going on with millennials. Gabrielle, where can we go?
You bet. So if any of your listeners are having a hard time understanding what motivates millennials, or especially if they're looking at how do you retain the millennial talent that you have, visit our website at millennialsolution.com, and you can download a free millennial retention checklist, as well as learn more about the other services and products that we provide.
Sarah will be interested in that, right, Sarah? That you like checklists, right?
Of course. I mean, I feel like this is more so for our, you know, for employers to see. I work in, you know, companies that are have, you know, working companies where it's more of an older generation and it's very, you know, kind of an outdated traditional system where the question gets thrown around with, well, what do millennials want? And we want feedback from millennials on what to do and how to keep, you know, the turnover rate low. And so I think that's a great resource for all of those companies to have that question. And what is a good place where we can follow you on Twitter, Gabrielle?
Absolutely. So you can follow myself and my company at Says Gabrielle, where we post where we're on great shows like your guys's, as well as upcoming speaking events when we're speaking at conferences, working with executives, or just doing what we love to do every day.
All right. Well, thanks for calling,
Perfect.
Gabrielle. We'll definitely look at some of the topics that come up through your team, and anything else involving millennials, we'll definitely have you back on. So thanks again for calling.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Take care. Thanks. Okay.
Bye-bye. Of course.
You're listening to
Neil
Haley
Goodbye.
Show. We'll be back in just a moment. All right, stand by, clear, save, and we'll get our next guest on.
Great. What does clear mean? Clear means it's clear.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, clear. Clear. We're back to Neil Haley's show on the Author's Corner / Surreal segment. And I want to welcome the program, first of all, my co-host, Sarah Bella. Sarah, how are you? And, you know, we go from a political talk to an author's book that seems very intriguing. Right, Sarah? Did we lose her? I thought I didn't hear her. Hold on a second. Sarah, are you there? I think I'm going to cut her off the
yes,
line.
Yes, I'm here. Sorry. You have a little bit of technical. Okay. Hello.
Oh, no, let me go
very
back.
Excited
I stopped the recording. Take two.
You stopped
ready, guys?
It. Okay.
Okay. All right. I'm good at these things, so, Rachel, I'll have some other way of saying it.
Yeah, okay, that's fine. No problem.
That's why I love recording. All right, Sandy.
Perfect.
We're back to Neil Haley's show on the Author's Corner segment and Surreal segment. I'm excited to welcome to my co-host, Sarah Bella. Sarah, I guess you're busy thinking millennial stuff still and how you can have a voice after talking to Gabrielle, right? It sounds like that, right, Sarah?
Well, I'm excited and ready, though, to still introduce an author now, Rachel Slade, author of Into the Raging Sea. How are you, Rachel?
Hi, thank you so much. Excited to be on the show.
All right,
so
fantastic.
Tell us about your book and what Into the Raging Sea is about. It sounds like a very driven title. Love to hear what it's about.
Oh, thank you. So in October 2015, an American container ship 800 feet long, this is a big container ship, sailed out of Jacksonville and right into a hurricane. And this ship went down, taking all 33 mariners aboard to their death, 15,000 feet below the sea. This was the worst maritime accident in 35 years for Americans. And what's remarkable about this story, other than the fact that it's such an incredible tragedy, is that we actually recovered the black box off the ocean floor 3 miles down. And so we have a 26-hour recording of all the conversation that happened on the bridge leading up to the accident. And this is, by the way, the longest transcript of a black box in our history. So it's just incredible how much information we have about the people on board.
Now, Rachel, how did you come up with it, wanting to write this book? What was the reasoning based on this tragedy? How did you learn about it, and why did you want to kind of add more to this by writing the book?
I've always lived on the East Coast, so I have this strong connection to the ocean. So I think subconsciously I was looking for a story that had something to do with the sea. When I first read about this story, and of course it was all over the news, I mean, it was national news for a while because they couldn't find the ship after it disappeared, after they lost communication. It took a long time to actually locate the ship. So as I was reading about that, I just needed to understand, first of all, how could we lose a ship? You know, in this day and age when you can track your dog and you can track your packages and you can track anything you want, how do we lose a ship? But the other thing that really drew me to this was the fact that this would be a way to connect to the men and women who are working aboard our ships, and the ships are what drives the global economy. They are the reason that we can, you know, have cheap computers made in China, and we can have, you know, cotton shirts from India, and all these things are affordable because they're carried on ships. And 90% of everything that we own, touch, on our backs, drive, comes from or has spent time on a ship.
What an incredible way to just take all of those stories and lives and just, you know, the events and just commemorate kind of what happened. And, you know, one of my questions is, why did, you know, El Faro sail straight into a category three hurricane?
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to know and what everybody wanted to know. A lot of people were saying, well, was the captain suicidal? And, of course, we didn't have any answers until we got that black box. And so when you read this 500-page transcript, you experience or re-experience the pain that all of these people were going through as they were trying to convince the captain to turn around. The reason that he sailed into the storm is complex, and of course that's why I wrote a book, because the decision-making, the flawed decision-making is so compelling to me. But really, I think it came from two things. One is he did not have good weather forecasting information. He actually had conflicting weather forecasting information on the ship. And the other thing was he was fearing for his job. These are good union jobs. They're hard to come by. And he had every reason to think that he was about to lose his job, and he thought this was a way to save it, to show his bravery.
So he was incompetent in certain ways that was already leading to his termination at that point in time that he knew about. Sounds like what you're saying.
I wouldn't say that he had proven that he was incompetent up to that point. I would say that actually there were things working against him which made a promotion more difficult, and most of those things were political, had probably less to do with his decision-making than to do with the shipping company itself and how they worked. So he was confused about why they weren't promoting him. He was nervous. He had high expenses, two girls in college. I mean, there are a lot of pressures on him, and I think we can all relate to that, which is why this book is so powerful, I think, the story.
Definitely seems like it.
Absolutely. And why was he so convinced that they would be fine? Well, you know, why was the captain so convinced that it would be okay to ignore all of the warnings?
Yeah. Well, for one thing, we haven't had an accident like this in 35 years, you know.
Yeah.
So when you're on that ship and you're heading into bad weather, you can reassure yourself that American ships don't go down, you know, and there were a lot of people on that ship who hadn't even been born when, you know, the Edmund Fitzgerald, for example, sank in the 70s. So it was such a distant past that it seemed impossible, inconceivable, that this ship would go down. I'm convinced that that's the case.
And if you talked about in the 70s, a ship that went down, is the Titanic before that, or are there others before that as well? Or after,
oh, well,
or
there
after
was
the Titanic?
There was the Marine, sure, there was the Marine Electric, which is a famous case. It was a ship that went down in 1982. Many U.S. merchant marine ships went down during World War II, and I'd just like to give a shout-out to the U.S. Merchant Marine. It is not part of the military, but they were conscripted to sail arms and troops to both theaters of war in the Atlantic and Pacific, and the U.S. Merchant Marine suffered more casualties than any of the armed forces during World War II. So plenty of those ships went down, and we lost a lot of good people.
Mm-hmm.
But that was from U-boat fire and other things. That was not, you know, sailing into storms.
It's incredible the way history has a way of repeating itself, you know, even as a, you know, Titanic, kind of not to compare it to that, but as that being an, you know, quote, unsinkable ship, and then to have this story where you wouldn't think that this would happen to an American ship. Why is it so important to continue to learn about what has happened so that, you know, we can prevent this, or just to kind of educate, you know?
There are so many things about the story that we can all draw from. It's not just about ships, although obviously there's a lot of ship in this. But really, it's so much about management and about listening to people. So, I mean, here is this captain, and he's convinced he's right, and he's going to beat this storm and take this ship through it and deliver goods on time. And then we have these incredible people standing next to him, trying every which way to convince him that he's wrong. Now, we've all had bosses who have made bad decisions or told us to do things that we didn't want to do. That's exactly the same position that these people were in. And like I said, they thought the worst that was going to happen was that they were going to get pretty seasick and knocked around in a storm.
Oh, jeez.
But they really tried. And that's what the horrifying thing about this narrative is that we have, you know, 26 hours leading up to this where each officer aboard, not the captain, but all the other officers, you know, you see them realizing slowly, slowly, inching closer and closer to their deaths, getting more frightened, but still being professional, still trying to respect their commanding officer. You know what I mean? It's just intense and incredible. And as I was reading that transcript and as I was writing the book and as I got closer to the people we lost, because now I know who they are, I've spoken to their families, you know, I've spoken to their colleagues, I know them, I kept saying to myself, what would I have done?
Yes. Wow.
Absolutely.
Yes.
You know, what,
I mean,
have
that's
people done?
Yeah.
What have people done?
Since, you know, 3 years now since the tragedy, what have people done to ensure this never happens again?
Well, I think the first thing and the most obvious thing is that now I think everybody, all mariners, are carrying this story in their hearts. You know, this story reverberated around the world as soon as it happened. And mariners, they're a small group, and they share these stories, and now they know. And they're just probably on much higher alert. And that in itself is probably already saving lives. Other things in terms of regulations and laws, that's a much slower process. But there are a few things that I hope happen. The National Transportation Safety Board and the Coast Guard both made recommendations, and those recommendations then go through a process where they figure out, where the commandant actually of the U.S. Coast Guard figures out whether or not these are valid concerns and should become changes in the law. And I think one of the biggest ones is getting open lifeboats off of these ships. Believe it or not, this ship was carrying lifeboats just like the ones on Titanic. It was a hull that was built, the ship's hull was built before 1986, which means it was grandfathered in. So she was carrying these very, you know, boats that nobody could survive a storm in.
Wow. Okay, Rachel, best place we can purchase your book and learn more about you, where can we go? Because it just seems like if you're interested in ships or you're interested in stories like the Titanic, you're really telling a story that's so new, and it also really shows what kind of danger people who travel in ships can happen and what to do and what not to do. And so where can we find info to purchase the book and learn more about you? Where can we go?
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, this is so much bigger than ships. I mean, this is really about Americans and unions and, you know, laborers. There's race. I mean, it's a very complicated story, and that's what makes it so rich and wonderful. So you can find my website. It's rachelslade.net. There's a lot of information on there, and you can find my book really anywhere at this point. It's up on Amazon, of course, but please... please support your local bookstore if you have one. I love my bookstores, and I'm really proud that people go there frequently.
Right. And where can we find you on social media?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter. I'm at RachelSlade1. And and I mentioned my website again. It's RachelSlade.net.
All right, well, fabulous. Well, thanks for coming on the show. We really, really appreciate it, Rachel. And it's a very, very interesting story that people need to pick up the book. The cover looks tremendous, by the way, as well, Rachel. I wanted to tell you that. And really,
great job on
everything. So thanks again for calling. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Take care. Thanks. All right.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Neil Haley's show. We'll be back in just a moment. Okay, clear? Thank you, Rachel. Talk soon, okay?
Thanks so much.
Appreciate
okay.
It. Bye. Appreciate it. Bye-bye. Bye. Stand by. Here we go. We're back to Neil Haley showing the Author's Corner segment and Surreal segment. And I tell you, I have had this co-host for, let's say, about 4 or 5 weeks, but I put her right to the fire with all these guests and she's interviewing, and I've been listening to her, and I said, you know what? She is talented, so I'm excited to welcome her, my co-host, Sarah Bell. Sarah, how are you? And, you know, every interview, it gets easier and easier. It's like riding a bike, more and more you do it. I mean, I have 7,000 or 8,000 under my belt of shows, but, hey, it is what it is, and it's a lot of fun. I think the fun thing, Sarah, the most is we learn something new from every guest, don't we, Sarah?
We do. It is. I mean, I don't nearly have as many people I've interviewed under my belt as you had, but maybe someday. But, you know, I am very excited to introduce our next speaker. She's an author and psychotherapist and mindfulness coach, Deborah Salazar-Shaparro, author of The Magical Mindful Day. Welcome, Deborah. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Thank you, Neil and Sarah, for having me. It's very kind and generous of you. I'm very excited. And hello to all the listeners.
All right. Well, fantastic. Thanks for being on, Deborah. Appreciate it.
Yeah. So I love psychotherapy. I love neuroscience. And I love stories of, you know, where you kind of learn about arriving to the United States, as I was born outside of the United States. So I'd love to hear your experience on growing up in El Salvador and how that influenced the creation of the Magical Mindful Day.
Yes, thank you. I think I was privileged to be born in El Salvador. Believe it or not, the experiences of witnessing extreme poverty, natural disasters and even grew up in times of war, made me really appreciate many, many things, starting with life and people in natural resources especially. So that is how I think I started to weave things into the book. Remember this appreciation. I grew up with a lot of gratitude. I was introduced to do a lot of service at a very young age. And that showed me the reality that there is a world out there with people that need kindness and compassion. So for me, it was wonderful. It was hard at times because, let's say, witnessing children begging on the streets or even knocking at your door asking for food. It's very tough, and you're a child probably the same age, so not understanding why. But that, once again, made me appreciate it, feel gratitude. And then moving to the United States, where there's a lot of opportunity and abundance, I could not just forget what I've learned and how did I grow up with. So those are things that I started to weave into the practices of heart-based practices that are kindness and compassion that are embedded in the magical mindful day.
Interesting. Now, Deborah, let's talk about El Salvador. When you grew up there, what year was that for our listeners to understand the years that you grew up in El Salvador?
I was born in 1975, so I was young when the war started. And I remember moving to Mexico. My father looked for a job with the Mexican government, and I remember he had a Eurovan, and I remember being on a wood stool in the middle of both seats with no seatbelt or anything. I remember so clearly that moment for a reason. And also, I lived for about 3 years in Mexico, and then my mother and I came to El Salvador. And when I was a teenager, I experienced a lot of uncertainty. There was war, and one of the things that made a big impact on me in my teenage years is one of the places that I used to visit, you know, at night. There was a shooting, and for us, it was so close. Wow, what is that? What did that mean to us as a young teenagers? Because mostly the area of conflict was outside of the city, so we were not in direct contact, but we see the news, and so that brought things very close to us, and it changed our perspective of life also once more, appreciate things, life. And it was difficult at times. I had an opportunity to work as a news reporter for about 6 months, and I had to cover a lot of sad things and death was some of the things that I used to cover, or not very happy things sometimes. So it just, you're face to face with reality of a country that is suffering. But once again, we're very, very, experiences that made me appreciate life and grew up and see things differently, definitely. The appreciation for life for me is big, big, big.
Absolutely. You know, I studied a little bit of neuroscience, but part of happiness is, you know, more than like just seeing what you don't have, but a core of appreciating what you do have. And it's interesting to hear about kind of the trauma of, you know, living in a kind of environment where it is kind of chaotic and war can take its toll. And so I think hearing these stories is really important, especially for kind of people who maybe get caught up in a more materialistic, consumeristic society where you're fueled by wanting more and obtaining more things, and then just going mm-hmm. back to realizing you really don't need so much stuff. All you really need is kind of the core things mm-hmm. that you appreciate to be happy, and it all goes, I feel, back to Maslow's triangle, Maslow's hierarchy, right? So the base yeah. is just having those core things that you need. And, you know, it's interesting, too, that the book is really focused on how mindful practice can help children and adults, too, because I find that a lot of things that you learn as a child are really those things that those, you know, lessons that you really need to take as an adult. So if more adults relearn those things they should have learned in kindergarten or as a child, you know, this book can really help adults too who maybe didn't get these lessons back then but can still get it now. So what, you know, what kind of mindfulness practices can help children and adults regulate these difficult emotions and trauma to kind of express their feelings better?
Yeah, so mindfulness, moment-to-moment awareness without judgment. I have a teenager and I have a three-year-old, and I see how can I teach them different ways of staying with things, staying with feelings. So for little ones, taking some deep breaths, and when, as they start growing up and stay more and more with their breath and learn about their bodies, recognizing sounds, they're starting to realize that feelings come and go. For example, they're like, it's a very common way of teaching that feelings are like bubbles, those soap in the air, that they come and go and pop, or weather patterns for, let's say, teenagers or adults. And when we learn to stay with difficult feelings, we start realizing that they really just go. They come and go, that we can stay. And then a more advanced thing to discover is that we are not our thoughts. And that's very important, that if we have feelings of sadness, there's just feelings and they will go away, that we are not a sad person or we're not an angry person. We're just having feelings. So that's very important, that moment-to-moment awareness. And something for me that has been life-changing, like I mentioned, is that discovering that we are not our feelings. And other techniques for children, little children, mindful bodies, teaching them to pay attention to sounds, using their senses, hearing, touching, smelling, tasting in a playful way. That's how we can introduce those simple practices. We can call it magical, we can call them superpower. There's so many ways to introduce mindfulness to children in different stages.
So Deborah, it's okay to have feelings, but yet you just don't want to. You want to be figuring out what you're thinking in so many ways, so that you don't label yourself and feel like, hey, I'm just depressed or I'm sad or I'm angry. This is just a feeling, and it's going to pass on, and you have to be aware of that.
Correct.
Sounds like what you're trying to explain. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah, and if we can teach children at a young age, that is powerful. I remember being a teenager and feeling I'm different, I'm weird, or this or that. And so I was using labels for myself and then realizing, no, there was just feelings at the very, you know, when I was older and I started learning about mindfulness. So it's beautiful to see children understand this concept so easily. They're so curious and their hearts are pure, and if they're open, right, if we introduce it in a very playful way, no pressure, they will be open to it, receive it as a tool, one more tool they can learn to help navigate life. That's how I see it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in certain research, it's shown that words really drive thought. So language really opens up thought and how someone kind of sees what they're feeling or what an emotion is. So do you find that giving people, you know, children, adults, anyone, more of a, you know, good word for what they're feeling helps them kind of more think about what they're feeling, and giving a word to it kind of understand exactly what they're feeling?
Yes, it was like Neil was saying, it's okay to have feelings. Feelings are, you know, anger can be a powerful feeling, and it's okay to feel it, and we have to normalize it for children. It's okay to be angry. It's okay to be frustrated and giving those words. And when children are able to verbalize, when you use the words, you're engaged with your brain, and that sends a signal that it's okay, it's soothe us, it's okay, I'm angry. Oh, and then if the other person is connecting with me, attuned with me, oh, yes, you're angry, it's okay. So the more we can teach children giving the right word for feelings, teaching them at the very young age to name feelings and verbalize them and saying it's okay, it will be okay. And we don't have to hide or keep it a secret. We have to normalize that. And when we're teenagers, if we find somebody we trust, it's good for them to express themselves rather than bottling up feelings and then exploding later on, right? Because they're frustrated or sad or feeling depressed or feeling lonely. It's okay. Very important to teachers. For children.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Deborah, this is fantastic. This is a book resource definitely for parents and their children, but also the parents to learn from this as well, because our reactions, how we react to our kids, how we show anger, how we show sadness, how we get over things is how our kids are going to act and interact. If we are doing these things, they're going to do the same thing. And so the more we can understand our feelings, understand it's okay to be angry, it's okay to be sad, but it's not a state of mind. It's just a passing feeling. Our kids will learn the same. So where can we purchase your book, Deborah, and learn more about you? Where can we go?
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. You can find more information about the book at themagicalmindfulday.com. That's, you can purchase it there, or you can purchase it also on Amazon. And also as well is my website. Either you type my name, Deborah Salazar Shapiro, or themagicalmindfulday.com. You can find more information.
Great. And where can we find you on social media also?
Social media, and I'm new to social media, but you can find me on Instagram at Deborah Salazar Shapiro, or Twitter, Deborah S. Shapiro, or Facebook, The Magical Mindful Day.
All right. Well,
awesome. Well, Neil.
Yeah,
Neil can definitely help you out with the social media, too. He's great at that.
Yes, wonderful.
I'm building Sarah's right now as we speak, and she's the millennial, but yet I'm going to build her following. And it's such an important thing to have those connections. And there's so many people available out there, Deborah, to connect with when you're selling a book, because finding your audience, you can create your own audience through Twitter and Instagram, where you really can't do that on the World Wide Web. You have an, and that's what's so great about social media. But I appreciate you calling, Deborah, and best of luck.
Once again, thank you for the opportunity. Have a good night.
Okay, bye-bye. See you, bye-bye. You're listening to the Neil Haley Show. We'll be back in just a moment. All right, clear, and I'll call you back. All right, Tara.
Okay.
Thank you. Good night. Bye-bye.